That's better. Good morning. Welcome to a short series. So we're just going to do a short series for 4 weeks. So the last session will be on the 8th of December. That's in 4 weeks from now. And we've called this series Few Words, Powerful Lessons. And the reason for that is, just to give a little bit of introduction, so we once mentioned this concept, but I think when we're doing a series on King Solomon, I'll share this with you. But a while ago, I have this computer program that I've told you about it before. That it's got Hebrew books in it, but it's got like thousands and thousands and thousands of books with an amazing search engine. It's like a huge library just on a little disk, which is quite phenomenal, modern technology. And although I love physical books, but don't have them all, so I do use it quite a lot. And I once came across a work. It's from the 10th, 11th century. It's called Mivchar HaPninim. Mivchar HaPninim literally means the chosen gems or something like that, like chosen one-liners. And it's written by Rabbi Shlomo ben Gavriel. And what he did was he divided up sort of categories of behavior, categories of ethical behavior and good traits in 17 categories, like love or humility or anger, that kind of thing. And he wrote a book. It's a short book. It's a book of one-liners, one or two-liners, like just powerful quotes. Since then, and it's, as I said, they're not sure exactly. The author lived in Spain. They're not sure exactly when it was written. It was somewhere between 1950 and 1150, somewhere in those 200 years. So it's a very early work. And he just goes through these different behaviors and explores them and shares wisdom about these different concepts. Today, really, there's more books written on that book. There's commentary written on the book and things like that. But these lines are about the 10th century, roughly. Right, so it's like 1,000 years ago. It's an early book. And he's got a particular style, because I'm going to share with you a few quotes soon. He's got a particular style. So he talks like in the third person. He talks about the chacham, the wise man, as if like referring to a wise person, like Amar ha-chacham, the wise man said, or the wise man observed. It's like, it's written in a way where there's a wise person sharing wisdom. That's how it's written. He's the author, but it's written that way, like that, you know, the Chacham said, and the Chacham observed, the Chacham asked, and he's like, or they asked the Chacham, and he said, that's the style of the writing. So I thought that it would be just a nice little thing to, because I love the book, it's just really nice sayings. I thought we'd look at some of the things over the next few weeks in this short series. And today it's written also, it's divided into the chapters, which he calls Sha'arim, gates. There are a lot of times Hebrew books are divided into sort of, the chapters are called gates. So the gate of this and the gate of that. I'm not sure why it's a Hebrew sort of style there. So today we're going to look at the Sha'ar Anava, the gate of humility. And we'll see, the Hebrew word for this is Anava, and normally translated as humility, right? Although it's not just humility, because we also need to understand what humility is. And we'll see how he defines humility from the various sayings the various quotes that he gives, and sort of why it's such a critical thing and how it affects other parts of living. Okay. So I want to just start with a little bit of an introduction. And introduction is based on something we've talked about a number of times. And that is just to, first of all, understand, particularly from a Jewish point of view, what is the definition of the word humility, right? Because often when we talk about the word humility, it conjures up imagery or words like nothingness or self-negation, sometimes in inferiority, unworthiness, being undeserving, those kind of things, right? And that's not true, because those things actually do not define someone that's humble. Because those kind of feelings like I'm nothing, I'm a failure, I'm not good at this, I'm not good at that, and all that kind of thing, putting oneself down is not humility. In fact, putting oneself down often comes from the very same source as arrogance comes from. which is a deep, deep insecurity. It's someone who has no self-worth, doesn't understand their own self-worth, doesn't understand their own competencies and their own areas of strengths and weaknesses for that matter. And therefore, there's two ways that expresses itself. Either it expresses itself, who's a person who's very insecure, it expresses itself in just putting themselves down all the time and just being like we call a shmata, I'm nothing and I'll take everything and you can do whatever you want to me and so on and so forth. And that's a weakness, not a strength at all. And in fact, it's not a good thing for any part of life. Not functionally, not spiritually, nothing, right? And in fact, what it does is, or sometimes it expresses itself in arrogance. So the inferiority complex and the superiority complex, as we've talked about many times, is exactly the same complex. Just how it expresses itself, right? And what happens also is that someone who has a very negative sense of self tends often to become very self-absorbed and very egocentric in a way. It's because it becomes about them. It's just what is about them. Sometimes it's about them. In other words, if it's all about me, so the me could be I'm wonderful and I'm amazing and I'm arrogant. All about me is that I'm terrible and I'm a victim and I'm always fails and I'm always have a rough run and all that kind of thing, right? So that's all part of, that's not humility. Humility is a good thing, not a bad thing. Judaism extols humility and talks about humility. In fact, we know that Moses was described as being someone that was anav, the same word that we're going to talk about, right? Ve'ish Moshe anav me'od, the Torah says Moses was the most humble person on the face of the earth, right? So what is humility, therefore? Just that's very, really important to define before we go on, because we'll see how this fits into the quotes in this particular book of how he describes humility. So humility really is the other way around. Humility is a person who actually has a very good sense of self. Not an arrogant sense of self, but a good sense of self. And that's very different, of course, right? In other words, a person who has a healthy self-esteem, understands their own weaknesses, understands their own strengths, is willing to use their strengths, is willing to take responsibility for their weaknesses, and is very secure. And because they're secure, they can be humble. Because what does actually humble mean? Humble means to make space for other people, not to be all about themselves. The humble person has a strong enough sense of self that they don't need to be all about themselves. There's plenty of room for other people, right? I've told you the story many, many times. There was a great Hasidic rabbi called the Tzemach Tzedek, and someone came to him to complain that in shul, everyone's treading on me, everyone's stepping on me. So he said to him, well, who told you to spread out yourself in the whole shul? Like, if you didn't spread yourself so big, they wouldn't separate you, right? In other words, that's the point, because a person insecure needs to be everywhere and everything just to control themselves and to make sure that they're still around, but to make sure everyone knows they're still around and so on and so forth, right? So a humble person can make space for other people. A humble person understands, and this is one of the key things, that yes, I have strength, but it's not me. It's God-given, it's a gift. God has lots of strengths, he has lots to go around, so I have a strength, someone else has a strength. I don't need to feel superior. Moses, we know, Moses knew his strengths. Right, this is the famous discussion. What does it mean that Moses was the most humble person? Moses knew that he was the greatest prophet. Moses knew that he gave the Torah to the Jewish people. Moses knew that he was clever, then he was smart, then he was unbelievable. I mean, he knew that. Right? Because if he didn't know that, that would be false humility. Right? And yet, he felt very humble because he didn't feel himself better than anyone else, because he knew it's not him, it's not his achievements, it's God-given. And he's doing his best to nurture and to express the gifts that God has given him, right? That's why there was no arrogance. He didn't feel humble, right? A humble person is secure enough to understand the point of view of another person with tolerance, with respect. A humble person is someone who goes about their strengths, goes about doing amazing things, but doesn't obsess with recognition, doesn't obsess with everyone knowing about it, but is discreet and does things in the spirit of humility. So, what does that mean? And I think this is very foundational to what we're going to talk about in terms of the quotes from this book. Humility is not a weakness, it's a strength. And that's the important thing to understand, right? If someone puts themselves down, self-negates all the time, that's weak. That's a weakness and it's negative. Humility is actually a strength and it's courageous. Because we all have a bit of an ego, right? And we all know that sometimes it's hard not to want recognition. It's hard to make room for another point of view. It's hard to make space for other people. When we do that, it's not a weakness, it's a strength and it's courageous. And it comes from strength. It comes from feeling strong and inner strength. Right? to be secure enough not to be so focused on ourselves, to be secure enough not to be trapped in ourselves, to be secure enough not to want to protect ourselves all the time. Yes.
You keep making a link between being secure and being humble. Can you just explain that?
Yeah, because normally you can't. Well, it's also how we become secure. The people who aren't secure within themselves find it difficult to be humble, because sometimes they just put themselves down. That's not really humility. And therefore they don't fill their potential. They don't use the gifts that God has given them, because they're too insecure. They're too scared. Everyone else can do better than me, so why should I try? Why should I even go? Right, look. And that's not what we're about, right? We're supposed to accomplish. Or they're so insecure that they're busy protecting themselves all the time, which means they don't make, they're not humble. They're actually arrogant. Arrogance comes from insecurity, right? We sometimes call it confidence, but it's not. Right? There's a big difference between healthy confidence and arrogance. Sometimes arrogance comes across as, you say, whoa, that guy has a big dose of confidence, right? It doesn't. It's just very insecure, right? Just a bravado, but, you know. So there is a very definite thing. But the security I'm talking about has to come also because when I'm secure within myself, from a Jewish point of view, from a Torah point of view, that security comes because I have nothing to be insecure about. Right? We talked about this many times, but I mean, this is not really the topic now, but I'm nothing to be insecure about because I have intrinsic worth, because I have a soul, I have a godly spark, that's what defines me, that's intrinsically who I am. I'm not a bad person because I made a mistake, because I can always do tshuva, I can always return, I can always reconnect, I can always repair. God tolerates, God abundantly forgives. I can take criticism because I know that I'm not a bad person, I've just made a mistake, so I can take responsibility for it. If it's true, I have no problem. That kind of thing, right? So that humility, which, like we talk about Moses being humble, it's because, in other words, humility is supposed to come. The more we understand how connected are we with God, I'm talking about humility from a Jewish perspective, the more connected we are with God, the more humble we should be. Because we don't have to protect this fragile little self. We're actually part of a much greater reality. We can handle making a mistake. We remain connected to God even after the mistake, so it's not a problem, right? It's easy to talk about this. I'm not saying it's that easy to implement. I'm just saying it's that's what humility is, right? And because it's a strength, an interesting thing we need to talk about humility, just to mention before we get into what I want to talk about, is that because it comes from a strength, it also means that the humble person, when needed, is able to use amazing strength, right? And to stand up. So the humble person has no need to be heard. He has no intrinsic need that every time he walks into a room, his or her opinion has to be heard, because he can make room for, she can make room for other people. But sometimes, because it's coming from a strength, the humble person is intrinsically strong. And therefore, because it's intrinsically strong, when needed, that same humble person is able to be strong, like Moses was. There were times that Moses stood up to the Jewish people with tremendous strength, because that was morally right. Right? I'll just share with you an interesting little insight that Lubavitch Rebbe says, called it Yaakov and the Sheep. You know, we're going to read, not this week, but in the coming weeks, in the Torah reading, in the Parsha of the week, we're going to read about the story of Jacob, right? Jacob had a brother Esau, there was a whole story, they weren't exactly compatible. And then we have the story where, because Jacob had taken the blessings from his father Isaac, Esau had it in for him and he wanted to kill him. So it ended up, Jacob ended up leaving Israel and went to his uncle, Lavan, who was not a very good person, he was a con man. And he stayed there for 20 years and married his two daughters, Rachel and Leah. Rachel and Leah were his first cousins, right? And Yaakov begins to work for his father-in-law. So he works for him for 20 years. And then, what does he work for? He's a shepherd. And how does he get paid? With sheep. And there's this incredible emphasis on sheep. He worked for sheep. He took care of the sheep. His wages were the sheep. First his wages were his wife. But then, like, he worked for Lavan so that he'd be able to marry his daughters. But then he worked for him, and Lavan paid him with sheep, and this color sheep, and that color sheep. Sheep, a whole parasha we read about sheep. And Yaakov actually became very wealthy, right, from the sheep. And then obviously using the sheep, he bought other things. Then he goes home. And on the way home, he sends messages to find out, like, has Esau forgiven him yet, right? So he sends these messages out to go see if Esau has, like, calmed down in the last 20 years. You know, we laugh about it, but you know, nowadays if we find people don't calm down even after 20 years. So, right, so So he gets a message back that Esav is coming to meet him with 400 soldiers. Well, that's not very good, right? So, okay, so he does many things. He prays, he sends him a lot of presents, he's very respectful to him. But he also sends him the following message, right? Finds him the selling message and he says, I just want you to know, I've been at Lavan's house for 20 years. And I've been blessed with amazing things. What I've been blessed with, he starts like this, he says, I've been blessed with oxen and donkeys and servants and maidservants. Like he goes through a whole list of things. And at the end, he mentions also sheep. Right? So it's an interesting question. You'll see what I'm getting to in a minute. But there's an interesting question here. First of all, he's trying to be very respectful to Esav, trying to win him over, trying not to get him on the wrong side because he doesn't want to be killed. And yet he goes and provokes him. He tells him, look, I've had all these amazing things. Which should have really made Esav upset because Esav was upset that he had stolen the blessings. And here he says, you know, I actually was really blessed. Look what I did. I mean, last 20 years, I've become a millionaire. Like, I'm amazingly wealthy. That's not going to go down very well with Esav. So why does he say that? And second of all, if the obsession of his wages and his work was all around sheep, how come he changes language all of a sudden? Right? How come he changes language and he says, he doesn't even talk about the sheep. He talks about, I've had oxen and donkeys and who knows what, and servants and maidservants, right? So a very interesting interpretation that I once learned on this is as follows. That journey that Yaakov took wasn't just a journey to his father-in-law's house and marriage and so on. It was also a spiritual journey, which you're not going to go into now. There's a whole body of Kabbalah talking about the journey of Jacob during those 20 years. But essentially, it was a spiritual journey. It was a journey of setting up a family that at the end would become the ancestors of the Jewish people. So his main work was sheep. Why sheep? Because in Jewish writings, every animal symbolizes something else. Sheep, because of its meekness, sheep is actually a symbol of humility. Right? And that's why Yaakov worked on this. Humility is a very foundational thing, as we'll soon see. And it takes a lot of work to be really truly humble. And Yaakov worked on that. That's why everything was about sheep. He was amassing sheep. Spiritually speaking, he was building up true humility. But as we just said, true humility is a strength. So Yaakov, when it comes to Esav, when you need to fight, you need to fight. When you need to stand up, you need to stand up. Not because you need to be heard, not because of you, but because it's the right thing to do. Right? So a humble person who is so weak that they can never stand up, that's not humility. Humility must come from a strength, and therefore strength means you need to be able to stand up if you need to be heard, and you need to stand up for evil, you need to stand up against immorality, you need to be able to do that with tremendous strength. As Moses did many very often in the Chumash, even though he was so humble. Right? So he sends Esav a message, he says, so when he's working with himself, the focus on him is to be humble. The true sense of humility. But then when he has to send Esav a message, the evil Esav, who represented not only physical evil and physical violence, but spiritual evil, and he says, I'm going to be respectful to you, I'll make room for you, I'm going to treat you nicely, but don't mess with me. Because if you think I'm weak, I'm not weak. Vayhili shor, I've traded the sheep for this humility. If it needs to be, it can translate itself into oxen, bulls, which is a symbol of strength. And other resources that I have, because I can be strong if I need to, because I've worked on true humility, and true humility means that when I need to be strong, I can. Right. So I'm just saying that to understand this concept that humility is a strength, not a weakness, and the test of it sometimes is what happens if it needs strength, like proper strength. It can happen too, because the humble person is about a person that is more interested in what's right and more interested in what is beneficial and true for relationships, for spirituality, for everything else, rather than him or herself. But if what is right in a particular situation, and that is sometimes right, but we've got to stand up in the face of evil or stand up with tremendous strength, the humble person can do that too, because everything about humility is coming from a strength. So that's just a bit of introduction about humility. So let's go back to this book of quotes. I mean, there's lots of quotes about humility. I just took a few. So this is how he expresses humility. Here's an interesting thing. Because you'll see how this concept of humility then expresses itself in different areas of living. So the first quote is a very interesting one. Again, I said the author talks like in the third person. So he says like this, he says, the wise man says, the chacham says, he says, Amar ha-chacham, right? anava, which can mean humility. It's interesting, I found online a translation of this book. And in this particular translation, the translator over here translates anava not as humility, but as diffidence. I have to check synonyms, know what diffidence means. Anyone know what diffidence means?
What?
What is it? Diffidence.
No,
diffidence. I think it means like to stand back, like hesitant, like to wait. Anyway, anava. We'll talk about anava means in a minute. Humility. Okay. He says anava is the keren. I'm using the Hebrew word specifically here because we'll see different translations of the word keren. Keren means it's like the cornerstone, the horn. The normally means like the horn of an animal, but it's the keren. It's like the foundation of the intelligence of wisdom. See, it's interesting thing. It says, anava, humility, is an expression of wisdom. Okay? I'm going to explain in a minute. The characteristic of the fool is boldness or arrogance, right? And then he says, and the result of all, I didn't change it there, diffidence, humility basically, is peace. Now let's understand this. So he says, anava, humility, is the keren, the foundation of the wise. Let's stop there for a second. So what does he mean? It's, to use the exact words that he uses in the book, he says it's the keren of the muscle, which means it's the expression, it's the manifestation of the intellectual, right? So let me share with you three interpretations of the word keren. This is what the commentaries talk about on this book. And the first is this interesting relationship between humility and wisdom. So what he's teaching us is that if you want to know if a person is truly wise, a person can only be truly wise if they're humble. Why? That doesn't mean that you have to be humble to know a lot of things. Okay, it's very different. Being really wise and knowing a lot are two different things. Right? There are people that are amazingly clever and knowledgeable and arrogant. Right? But they're very stuck. In Pirkei Avot, in Ethics of the Fathers, we learn that Ezeu Chacham, who's a wise person? Halomed mikol adam, someone who can learn from every person. Hear the emphasis, not someone who can learn from others, because then you can say, well, everyone learns from someone, right? But a person who can learn from everyone, meaning everyone, a great teacher, a great student, a friend, a colleague, or anyone in the street. You can learn from everyone. Why? Because there isn't a person in this world that doesn't have a contribution to make. If they know less than me or more than me, it makes a difference. There isn't a person in the world who doesn't have a unique perspective. As we know, everyone thinks differently, everyone creates differently, everyone has different creativity, right? And one of the themes that comes out of the quotes in this book, from other quotes as well, this Mifchar Pnim that I'm quoting from, about humility is the sign of someone who's humble is someone who's able to wait, have self-control, not push themselves forward, but hesitate. I don't mean hesitate in an ambivalent way. I mean hesitate in terms of, let's wait. Let's wait what someone else has to say. Let's wait before I blow up. Let's wait before I act impulsively. Right? The inner security to say I don't need to jump in right away is a sign of true humility. And that type of waiting leads to the ability to learn from others. A true wise person in conversation is much more interested in what the other person has to say than what he or she has to say. Now that's heck of a difficult. We all know that, right? Because we're all eager to share. And we should share. But we often think that the way we understand it is the way it should be understood, right? And that's okay. We need to defend our position too, but that's all right. But learning from other people, right? So this quote says that the wise person says that the keren in this case means the manifestation, the strength of the intellectual, of the true wise person, is humility. And that connects to what it says in Pirkei Avot, because the true wise person is able to learn from every single person. Right? Giving space, giving back, standing back, making room for someone else's opinion. Just as last Sunday was, I think I've shared this to you before, this last Sunday was the yahrzeit of Dina's father, my father-in-law of blessed memory. A very, very special person. He was, I knew him before I knew Dina. He was my teacher in yeshiva. He was one of the head rabbis in the yeshiva that I studied in Morristown, New Jersey. He was an unbelievable Torah scholar, an incredibly wise person, and an incredibly knowledgeable person. I mean, he knew the entire Talmud, basically by heart. He knew thousands of books, but he was an amazing, amazing individual. But his greatest strength probably was the fact that he was incredibly humble. He never pushed himself forward. Even silly things, like I mentioned this last Shabbos, when we go to ask him, where do you find this particular passage in the Talmud? And he would know exactly where it was and what page it is and everything. He would always wait and he would say, I think it's in that book, around the page. Not exactly. Anyway, he knew exactly where it was. But that's just because he didn't want to, you know. But where I saw this concept played out with him, and I think this is probably one of the people that I can use as an example of where I really saw this idea. So he was a very old-fashioned person. He was 50 years in America and spoke a very, very broken English because he was always in yeshiva speaking Yiddish, and his world was the world of learning. He wasn't that interested in what was going on in the wider world, unless it would further his knowledge and he's able to teach and that kind of thing, right? So in those days, I remember it was like the 80s, I think it was, the iPods became very, remember iPods? This is before iPhones, right? iPods became very, very fashionable. And they had these, around yeshiva time, they had these iPods that someone had put on, like in the subjects that we were learning in yeshiva, for example, you know, Hasidic philosophy or Talmud or halachic works, they put on these shiurim, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shiurim from different lecturers and from different teachers. They put them all on the iPod. Anyway, someone showed him, he was very impressed on this amazing technology. So someone arranged for him an iPod with all the stuff downloaded, all the talks of the Rebbe, all the talks of teachers. And sometimes when I was really married, I would be at home and I would see him taking out an iPod and listening to a shiur. I'd say, what are you listening to? He said, yeah, he's listening, you know, that discourse that we're learning in yeshiva, he's listening to this particular teacher who taught the same passage, you're listening to his shiur. I think to myself, like, why? You don't need that guy's shiur. Like, you really don't. I mean, he was older than that guy. He was more knowledgeable than him. He definitely gave. I mean, he really didn't need to listen to that lecture on the same passage that he was studying from the other person. And this happened very often. And I would say to him, like, why are you listening to? And he always had this one line he would say. He says, you know, because maybe I'll, you say in Yiddish, ich'll hear nepes anander wort. He says, I'll hear something. A knach, used to say. I'll hear like a nuance, a perspective that I didn't know before. Amazing. Like, you know, most people say, I don't need, you know, I know this stuff. I don't need to listen to that. He was like an unbelievable example of Lamed Mikol Adam. And when I saw this yesterday, I was looking at the saying that the link between wisdom and humility. And I thought of him because that's like, there you saw the incredible link. Because he never... And always, even when we discuss with him in yeshiva, you know, sometimes there's different ways of interpreting the same passage, of a Talmudic passage. That's what happens in yeshiva. People argue with each other and they sort of analyze it differently. He's always very quick to hear how someone else, he might not agree, but just to hear the perspective of someone else. And that creates a true wise person. That's one idea. Where we say that just in terms of learning, in terms of wisdom, in terms of knowledge, the true knowledgeable person... Because when someone knows a lot but they're arrogant, they get stuck. And often you find this, I mean, in years of yeshiva learning and things like that, you know, there's always the odd person who was incredibly knowledgeable but incredibly arrogant. And you see how eventually they would, you say in Yiddish, they would fablonge, which means they would like lose their way because they'd come up with such distorted ways of understanding things because they were never ever willing to listen to someone else. Never willing to understand, maybe I made a mistake or maybe it's glaringly obvious that that's not the way to understand this passage or whatever the case is, right? So that's one idea of what he's saying here. The second interpretation, and I saw this one of the commentaries about the word keren, right? Keren means a horn, literally speaking. So why does he say that keren, the humility is the keren of the wise? He says because keren means strength, right? Strength. So why? What does it mean, strength? So why? How does strength have to do with humility, as we said before? He says, because a person who's humble becomes stronger than other people. What does he mean? He says, this is the hard thing to implement. It's easy to talk about, but it's very hard to implement, right? He says, people who have the strength, not because of a weakness, but because of a strength, to hear someone scream at them, to hear someone create conflict with them, to hear someone insult them or offend them, and to wait and to be calm and not to answer, which on the surface seems weak. But when it's not coming from a weakness, but it's coming from a strength, eventually, who comes out the stronger person? The humble person. He says, you see this in the story of Yaakov and Esav. Even though Yaakov let Esav know that he was strong if he needed to be. But if you look at the story, when Esav came to meet Yaakov, actually Yaakov was very, very conciliatory. He referred to him as my servant. He gave him presents. He deferred to Esav almost, where it was okay too. At the end, all the 400 soldiers disappeared. Esau's heart was aroused, had compassion, and he left Yaakov alone. Some of his descendants haven't done yet that, but they're still working on it. But right. But Esau left Yaakov alone eventually, right? Because one of the great links, which he talks about later, as we'll soon see in the next quote, humility. Even in this one, he says the result of all humility is peace. Why? Because it takes two people to fight. At the end of the day, it takes two people to fight, right? And when someone picks a fight with you, we have the dance, what we call the dance of anger. As we've talked about this many times, right? Someone who's insecure or outrageous enough or arrogant enough or ineffective enough to pick a fight in an offensive and very, very sort of aggressive way, right? And screams at us and offends us, pushing our buttons. When we say pushing our buttons, we mean pushing the buttons of our ego, basically. The temptation, obviously, is to fight back. When you fight back, you just create more conflict. But when you have anava, which he refers to as waiting, deferring, hesitating, thinking, picking the right time, perhaps waiting till you can have a good conversation, or whatever the case is, showing love back is a very hard thing to do. The Talmud says that when a person is shomea cherpato ve'eino meshiv, when a person can cop offense from someone else and not respond, the reward for that is amazing. Why does the Talmud say the reward for that is amazing from God? Because it's a very hard thing to do. But that's the true courage of humility, the true strength of humility. And I know sometimes I've had this discussion with people and they argue, but they say, no, that's a weakness, not a strength. You've got to let the person know what, you know, you've got to let them, you're also a person. I'm a person. Where it's necessary, I will. But if just for the sake of letting them know what I feel, exacerbating the conflict, making it stronger, the end of that is conflict and regret, as he says in the next quote. But if you can have the strength to be humble, meaning we stand back, say, fine, I'm sorry you feel that way, and just not fight back, eventually, it keeps snapping. It's very tiresome for one person to fight. For a good fight, you must have two.
Right?
But even if you know they're wrong. Ah, that's it, right? I was waiting for someone to say that. But they're so wrong, right? Exactly. How can I let them get away with it? Because you're wise, that's why. And that's what he's saying.
Is that the ego speaking?
Yes. Because what do you mean? How can I go away and I wasn't heard? The I didn't come out. The I is ego.
It's a typical difficulty that I have with this. It's often like when I am at the place that I have, like, I want to fight back, but then I don't want to get into conflict. I can't talk, so I just leave. And no one really understands why I've left necessarily. And I find that, I mean, I know it's just personal, but it's a confusing part to what do you actually do then? Because you've got anger rising in you. So
you mean like in a case where you're worried that you're not going to be able to control it, so the better thing is to leave, yeah. So yeah, that's a practical thing. So, I mean, in that kind of thing, you need
but
to...
You need
a good exit strategy which is gracious and not so obvious.
Right.
Because otherwise it's passive aggression. Like, you know, when someone in the thing says, you know, someone gets up and like, they're not saying it, but you could read all over the face, like, I've had enough of this, I'm leaving. That's response.
Yes.
So you got to find a way of doing that, you know. There's a beautiful expression. I once heard from my sister-in-law in Yiddish. That there's a beautiful expression. Sometimes someone doesn't say anything, but they're saying volumes. If you know a bit of Yiddish, it's beautiful. I'll translate it. It says, in Yiddish, the expression, Vos schweigst du azay hoich, which means, why are you being quiet so loudly? Yes, like zalking or passive aggression. But over here, we're talking about that. No, you're kind back. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be the person's best friend. Doesn't mean that you have to become hurt by that person long term. It doesn't mean that the person can then drive you as a license to step all over you. No. Because remember, we're talking about humility from a strength, not from a weakness. And doesn't mean that you're afraid of a difficult conversation. Because if you're afraid of a difficult conversation, that's a weak way of avoiding confrontation. It's very subtle, this. It's very important. I'm being quiet not because I'm afraid and weak. I'm being quiet because I'm making a conscious decision to be quiet. Because it's effective. Because I'm strong, not because I'm weak. And because I'm wise and strong. And that's the second interpretation of what he's saying here, that anava, humility, is the keren, it's the strength of the wise.
Right.
And that's why it brings peace. So children is different, by the way. Young children are different. Your own children, young children are different because you have an obligation that they shouldn't be disrespectful. So, but even then, you have to be wise about it. Sometimes, actually, it's not good to respond right away, even with children. In my parenting class, I always tell people timing is everything. And when you deal with something in the moment, it normally doesn't work. They just go slam four doors, that's all. You don't teach them anything, right? But you can put a stop to it and say, no, you need to leave now, or that kind of thing, and you can talk about it later when it's calm, right? And if someone has the wrong information, and it's important that they have the right information, it depends how it's done. So normally the waiting is, that's why he links anava, humility, with waiting a lot, right? Because ego is always in a big rush. So I need to be there, right? Wisdom has patience, and humility has patience. So later on, when everything has calmed down, and you think that by communicating the information will start to change things, it'll make the relationship better. Not always the rule, by the way, because sometimes people have different ways of thinking. Then it's a good idea to do it in a respectful, constructive way if you think it'll work. Which is always harder, because actually it's easier to impulsively respond. Right? That's why the strength of humility is to be quiet, but also sometimes the strength is to have the difficult conversation in a constructive, respectful way, which is sometimes much harder. Normally it's much harder. People find it much easier just to be angry and shout back. But, right? It works. It's an unbelievable thing. Because I've experienced it. Now, again, I promise you, I'm not a very perfect person at all. But the couple of times that I've tried this, it actually works with time. There are individuals that wouldn't speak to me for a long time, and they're good friends with me today. Because I just didn't fight back. On the contrary, I'm thinking of one particular case where I would make a point. Every time I saw the person, I'd just graciously say good morning. For a while, they wouldn't even respond. But that's their problem. When I see a person, I say good morning. Right? And that kind of, and eventually, people come around.
Is it also, are we also responsible to then give that person a reason at some point? Or as in, if they keep doing the same things and they're not going to... And we've tried to say that this doesn't work for the relationship for us.
So when you're in an ongoing relationship, this might be a bit different, right? Sometimes, again, even then, you need to have a conversation and work it out properly. And there are times where there's a long-term relationship. It could be a business relationship. It could be a deep relationship where you're not prepared to have conflict, but you're also not prepared. It's just not working. And then sometimes relationships do need to come to an end because of that. So each case is different. And it all depends what... No, because I think they just need to know that you're not out to get them. You see, they normally person's angry because they really think that you did something terrible, right?
So it's not your job to make them feel okay, like that you're not doing that?
Time does that. Because, no, because you see, sometimes it's very difficult because sometimes people just think differently to you. And no matter what you're going to say, it's not going to help. So it all depends on the situation. But it's that waiting and that not fighting back that is so important. And the third interpretation of the word keren, we find in Mishnah Kibbutz that keren sometimes means it's ongoing. And this is a very important thing. Humility is not a trait. It's a way of life. It's just a perspective of life. Right? In other words, so you have traits that are like single traits, good characteristic traits. So a person is particularly kind, for example, right? A person loves to do chesed. Some people do, some people don't. Some people do some of the time. So it's not bad or good necessarily. I mean, you need to be kind when we talk to people, but I'm saying some people excel in kindness. Some people excel in discipline. Some people excel in, I don't know, something else, right? But he says a person who's truly wise, the person who wants to live a wise way of life, anava, humility is not a trait. That's something you have or you don't have, or one day you have, one day you don't have, one day I'm going to... It's something you need to work on to become a way of life. And that's the third interpretation of keren. So, knowledge, learning, to grow in knowledge, to be truly wise, requires humility. To be wise in emotionally wise, in other words, our relationships and peace and avoidance of conflict, we need humility. And humility is and the third interpretation that humility is the keren, which means it's the permanent state. It's the way, it's the perspective, it's the mindset of someone who wants to live an effective life. Which goes into the next saying. Oh, sorry, I should have put it before. All right. Those are the three things. Sorry, you want to put it back? Yeah, no problem. And then he sums it up in a different quote, but it's sort of the same thing. He says, it was the favorite observation of the sage, right? This is the sage that he keeps talking about. It's a figurative sage, I think, right? That discord, conflict, ends always in regret. Meekness, I don't know, that's a funny translation. That's his translation I took it from. Like humility, in other words, always ends in harmony, right? In Hebrew, it sounds much better. Acharit kol katata is charata. In other words, the end of every conflict is regret. The end of every anava, the end of every humility is shalom. Expressed a little bit differently, another beautiful thing he says, it was asked of the sage, he says, in what one virtue are all the rest compromised? And he answered, patience. Now in Hebrew, the word that he uses actually is saval, like savlanut. Right? Which is the same word as tolerance. Same word as, what do you mean tolerance? Making space. Stopping. Not rushing. Not being impulsive. And it's in the shat, in the chapter of humility, because that's what it is. So he's saying it's so foundational that it's actually the basis of every other good trait. Right? And this is connected to something you once spoke about, you know, that even good traits need humility. A person is kind, you know, but there's different ways of being kind. Kindness also means not just enough to be kind. Kindness means you need to be kind to a person the way it will be good for them. Now, we've talked about this before. Right? A person can be very kind. So he's going to visit someone that's sick in hospital and they land up there and sitting there for an hour and a half driving the person absolutely crazy. It's kind. I'm so kind. I give up an hour and a half of my day to go and visit. Yes, but you tire the person out and you're compromising his health. Be sensitive. Read the audience. You walk into someone, maybe you need to be there for 2 seconds. It's also good enough. Just know, so they should know you care. Maybe they need you for longer. Right? It's got to do with humility. In other words, don't be wrapped in yourself. Read outside yourself. It's not about you. It's about that person. And many, many examples like that. So every good trait actually is based on this concept. It's based about not being wrapped in yourself, being able to see beyond yourself. Something he doesn't talk about, but I'm just going to share it with you, is humility and happiness. A very interesting thing. And I just studied this again. I've studied it many times, but there's a discourse, an essay written by the Lubavitcher Rebbe that talks about the link between humility and happiness based on a verse in Isaiah where Isaiah the prophet says that the humble will be happy with God or increase in happiness, something like that, right? And he says an interesting thing. On the surface, we don't see that automatic link between humble and happiness, right? Humility sort of seems, the image of humility seems more sort of a closed kind of trait where happiness kind of is expansive, right? Now's not the time to go into the whole idea of happiness, but we know that happiness is not necessarily pleasure. It's not necessarily, happiness is a state of mind, right? It's an inner state of fulfillment. It's an inner peace, inner calmness, inner contentment, right? And he explains over there a very fascinating thing, and he says, there's an absolute link between humility and happiness. Why? Because someone who's very locked in themselves, protecting themselves all the time, builds an incredibly strong sense of entitlement. And entitled people are not happy. Right? The humble person, the way we explained at the very beginning, right? The humble person, the person who knows their strengths, knows their weaknesses, knows their talents, knows their skills, but knows that everything is a gift. He's like Moses. He knew who he was, but he said everything's a gift. That person is never entitled because everything is amazing. That's why we have this concept of gratitude, right, for the simple things in life, because I don't deserve anything. Not that I don't deserve it. I don't expect everything. It's got to do with expectation. The person who's not humble, the person who's insecure, the person who's always about themselves, has a string of unreasonable expectations, and the more they have, the more they need, they're never happy. Happiness comes from humility. Another foundational concept of humility. Because if I'm humble, which means I know that everything in life is a gift from God. It's not my doing, it's a talent that God gave me, it's a success that God gave me, I need to be grateful for it, and everything I have, I'm grateful, then everything you're grateful, then there's a state of happiness. It's beautiful. So that's also an interesting link between, he doesn't talk about it so much in the book, but it's another concept. We talk about happiness, how that needs the concept of humility. Just before we end off, I've shared with you the story before, but in the Talmud, one of the great sages that was incredibly humble, was Hillel, right? And just to end off and emphasize this point, that humility is really a strength, right? So Hillel was incredibly humble. Hillel was a great sage. Hillel was an unbelievable sage, right? One of the leading sages of all Jewish times, towards the end of the Second Temple. And he was so humble that he never got angry. Because anger, of course, is linked with arrogance. Right? And the Talmud tells us a crazy story that two people made a bet. And the one guy says, he challenges his friend, he can make Hillel angry. So the guy says, if you make Hillel angry, I'll give you 2 zuz, which was a lot of money in those times. 2 coins, 2 gold coins. So he comes to Hillel's house on Friday afternoon when it's very hectic. And every Jewish home on Friday afternoon is a little bit hectic. And apparently Hillel is in the middle of he's taking a bath. He's in the same part of the house that has the bath. I don't know, in those days, taking a bath was a big deal. You had to heat up water and all that. And he screams with disrespect. Doesn't say Rabbi Hillel, says Hillel, Hillel lives here, Hillel lives here. So Hillel comes out and he says, yes, my son. He gets dressed, comes out. What can I do for you? And he asks some like ridiculous question, like why the Babylonian feet are flat or something. Babylonians have flat feet. He says, oh, it's a very good question. He explains to him. He goes back with it. Anyways, that happens 3 times, right? Happens 3 times. After the 3rd time, he asked him why the details. It was always a ridiculous question. And Hillel kept on, right? And at the end, he says to Hillel, are you like Hillel, the sage that people say about you, that you're very humble? He says, my name is Hillel. She says, well, there should be none other like you. So Hillel says, my son, like, what's bothering you? You seem angry. He says, because of you, I lost 2 zuz. So Hillel said to him, I want to teach you something, my child. He says, rather you should lose 4 zuz, but never become angry. And never make me angry. Right? Now, if you look at the story, just the story, in an isolated way, especially in the context of some modern literature, how come Hillel didn't create boundaries and protect himself, and you know, all the stuff they talk about today, right? Which is all good in some cases. He's the sage, he's the chief rabbi. I mean, what are you bothering me in the middle of a bath? Ask me about Babylonian feet. I mean, come on. Right? So that would be true if it came from a weakness. You see, the Hillel's story, if it comes from a weakness, it just can't say no to anyone, then that's a problem. But it didn't come from a weakness. It came from humility. It came because Hillel chose to be incredibly compassionate to that person because he must have sensed that person needs it. And he was willing to be bothered three times to do it. Right? How do we know it came from his strength? Because Hillel was an incredibly strong person. Because he wasn't a weak person at all, because when he needed strength, I mean, it was obvious that it was there. The genesis of Hillel was that he was desperate to learn. He wasn't like we call a shvacha person. He wasn't a weak person. He wasn't a shmat at all. But one of the stories with Hillel is when he came and he wanted to learn and he wanted to listen. His teacher was the great Shemaya Naftalian, and he came on a Friday night when the shiur was happening and he wanted to learn, and you needed to, on Friday evening, Friday afternoon, you needed to give the guard at the door, you need to pay to get in. And Hillel was incredibly poor and he didn't have any money. And he used to chop wood, and this was before he became a great sage. And he used to chop wood and he used to have one coin, half a coin he would use for his household needs, half a coin he would use to get into the Beit Midrash for the shir, right? And one day he didn't have anything and he told the guard, you need to let me in. He said, no, I'm sorry, the guard wasn't there. So Hillel went and he climbed on the roof in order to hear the shir, and started to snow, and he was so engrossed in the shir, he didn't even know it was snowing. Until he froze. And then as the morning was coming, the shir went the whole night. It's a fascinating story. They saw that the skylight is not working. And they realized there's a person there, and they went up and they revived him, and so on and so forth, and they let him in for free for that. But he became the best, right? He had that strength, and he had the strength to, we in the Talmud, he had the strength to take on another school. He led a school of thought which was opposed to a different school of thought. The two schools of Hillel and Shammai, both great sages. And who do we follow today? We follow Hillel. Right? He became the victorious one. He became the one that we listen to his halachic rulings till today. And the Talmud says, you know why? Because even if he's arguing with Shammai, the school of Hillel would always listen to what Shammai had to say first. Respect, humility, but from a strength. He didn't say, oh, you know what, okay, we're not going to argue with you. No, we're going to listen to you. But they had the strength to argue back. Shammai was a very strong school of thought. But when Hillel said the halakha is different, he had the strength to say no. He had the strength to disagree. He let the guy bother him for three times on a Friday afternoon, but he had the strength to stand up to others and say, no, the halakha is not like that. I'm not going to just agree because I need to be honest. And if I think the interpretation is like this and I think the ruling is like this, this is what's going to be. And we follow the school of Hillel till today. So, humility, as we've been talking about and describing it, is not a weakness. It has to come from a strength. And when it's a strength, then we have the courage to be humble. We have the courage to let people bother us sometimes. We have the courage to make room for others. We have the courage to learn from others. And then it becomes a tremendous strength and a tremendous foundation to everything else. And that's why the last quote is interesting. He puts it in this chapter. He says, to choose good is to avoid evil. And now that's a general statement, nothing to do with humility, but he chose to put it in the chapter of humility, because obviously he's referring to humility, because humility, as he said before, is the foundation of everything else. And therefore, if you choose good, in other words, you choose humility, you're avoiding so much other evil, discord, conflict, lack of wisdom, lack of courage, and so on and so forth. So that's just a couple of quotes from the humility chapter. The next 3 weeks, we'll take quotes from some of the other chapters, and have a wonderful week. Oh.